Welcome to the For the Church podcast, another great gospel-centered resource from Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. My name is Jared Wilson. I'm an assistant professor of pastoral ministry and author in residence at Midwestern Seminary. And I'm here, as always, with my friend and my colleague and my co-host, Ross Ferguson. I don't know if we should, I'm going to ask you,
okay,
proceed with a few minutes of banter.
Oh,
because
yeah.
I've heard recently,
it's not a good thing,
on social media that banter's bad.
Yeah.
People skip it.
So
they don't want two people to just talk about things other than the topic of the day.
I was looking after someone else's kids. We were like babysitting for somebody, and I was just sitting out on a chair outside enjoying the sun, and I thought, oh, I'll just see what's happening on the old Twitter sphere. And I open up, like, Jared's commented on something. There's like 50 comments seen by 10,000 people. I was like, what's going on here? And there's a part of me that's like, oh, something's happened.
Yeah.
And what's happened is someone doesn't want banter on a podcast. They said, give me facts straight. I don't want any nonsense.
Just the facts, man.
And one thing, first of all, I thought, and 10,000 people want to look at this. But yeah, why do you want to listen to a podcast that's just straight facts?
To me, it's the people, it's like download the data into my brain as fast as possible. It's the kind of people that don't read whole books. Yeah. They want the book summaries. Who needs that all that extra illustration? Just give me the information.
And the first thing I thought was, what podcast are you listening to? Because that banter must be bad that you're saying, I don't want it anymore.
Yeah. But I was just trying to say, like, look, people read books differently. You listen to podcasts differently.
That's okay.
But what was being said was, so this guy was like, I don't like it. And the other guy was like, yeah, nobody does. No one should do this. And I'm like, hold on a second. Can't we have a variety of different kinds of things for different people? And so I was just trying to give a counter opinion, which was like, I only listen to podcasts where it feels like there's people at a table having a conversation. And it may be a reason why I don't honestly listen to a whole lot of Christian podcasts because either they don't do the banter or they're not good at the banter. Yeah. I want to feel like I'm listening in on Friends.
And actually, plenty of people commented, For the Church is a podcast they think it gets the banter right. So
we appreciate it. So let's banter.
Yes, banter. We went for lunch recently together, went out for lunch with the family. And my kids are still in the phase, or they certainly were until the lunchtime, that Jared's a little bit scary to them.
What? Why?
And not because of Jared. I would say any guy that I do ministry with to them is like, oh, that's like serious. That's ministry people. So I don't know if you figured this out, but they were quite like nervous energy talking because they were all talking over each other.
And Miriam and I thought they were being little girls.
Well, they were, but Miriam and I spent the entire lunchtime like tapping her, like going, your sister's speaking, your sister's speaking, your sister's speaking.
And that was because of my presence at the table? Well, they don't normally do that?
Well, they normally do that.
Okay. I just thought they were being themselves.
Yeah. But that meal was interesting for many reasons.
Okay.
One of the biggest reasons were, I'm convinced that the server didn't really like us.
She didn't
and
like us.
You're pretty sure about it too. My wife had to repeat things multiple times, and I think it was the accent thing. I'm not quite sure. And all that was going through my head is, I'm trying to be really polite while one of my pastors is sitting next to me and in front of my three kids. But this server is really bugging me, you know?
Yeah, when I first sat down, y'all had been there for a few minutes before I got there. So I think she was being pretty rude to you guys. So I sat down and I could feel the coldness a little bit. And then I thought she kind of warmed up a little bit. But you said after I left.
Then you left.
Because I had to check out. But after I left and you guys were having dessert.
Yep, same issue.
She just dropped off.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep, just disappeared.
I mean, she wasn't.
So you made the difference.
She wasn't a young server. No. She wasn't an old lady or anything, but she seemed like she was an older lady. And I would expect an older lady, especially with like you had these three little Scottish princesses there, that she would have been sweet. She'd be like a mommy or something, but she was
the
not,
biggest frustration.
She was not feeling it.
This is so talk about beefs. My biggest frustration, our table was overflowing with dirty plates. Like every time something came out.
Yeah.
And I'm just like holding them, the dirty plate going, I don't even know where to put this. I've got like a mountain in front of me because, you know, kids, you gotta take the plates and glasses away from them or they're gonna end up on the floor. So I'm just holding them and she's just standing there looking at me. I'm going, You want to do something about this? And she just keeps loading us with like food. And I remember when all the plates came out, you had like two plates. I had two plates. I think Leah next to me had a plate. And I was just thinking, there isn't space to have all this here.
Yeah.
So I was internally losing it and trying to just be calm, because like the lunch was nice. Everything was, you know, I had no issue with that, but it's just one of those things. If you want to get me to just pop with frustration, just leave all the dirty plates on the table and that's going to do it. Because here's my thing. I've had enough meals with my kids that I've seen the plate fly off the table, and it just happens by some Holy Spirit moment of teaching me some patience. Oh, you turn around, the plate smashed on the floor. How did that happen? Don't know. Just happened.
Yeah. I don't like cluttered tables either. And for me, it's not necessarily like the plates. It's when you first sit down at a place and they've got like the, now there's the computer thing, you know, the Zosk or whatever.
Yeah.
There's a big computer, you know, tube thing on there. They got a magazine rack that's got the menu and all of the spices and the ketchup, this big metal contraption that's got everything in there and just all the stuff piled up on the table. And I'm like, I just want a place to eat. Yep. I don't want all this stuff everywhere. Yeah. That really bothers me.
So basically, if you don't like banter on podcasts and you've switched off, that's on you. This banter's great.
This is really boring banter, I'll be honest. We're just talking about restaurants. It seems like most of our banter is about like food.
Food and movies. That's our life, food and movies.
Hey, it's a mailbag episode. Now that we've talked about the pros and cons of eating out, let's talk about the pros and cons via Bob on Twitter of VBS, Vacation Bible School. Mm. Can you talk about the positives and negatives of Vacation Bible School? Yep. Is this a thing you had in the UK?
So VBS is distinctly American.
Okay.
We do have a version. It's like summer camp, summer group type thing. It is a version, but VBS here is mainly kind of got Lifeway behind it. Lifeway produces a lot of stuff.
There's a bunch of different companies that do it.
But we don't have that in the UK. So we don't have a Christian company that's producing this. So we'll take some like American stuff, but ultimately we'll just have like a summer camp type thing, very similar to VBS, but VBS is an American thing. I'm a negative guy generally, so do you want me to hit the negatives yet? No. So I'll give one of each.
Okay.
Major positive, it reminds our children that the gospel is also for them. You know, we have a lot, like even if you look at your service generally on a Sunday, the vast majority is geared in language and style to those that are older. We do include children, but ultimately they are included, not the primary audience, if you will. And so I think VBS gives them the opportunity to know that the gospel is indeed for them, and you have specific services, activities designed in an age-appropriate way. So I think that's great. A major negative for me is the exhaustion that your church goes through in that week. You know, our church does VBS. It takes something like 35 volunteers, something like that, for our church to do. We probably over egg a little bit on the volunteer side, but it is exhausting to spend a week preparing, running, feedback, connecting Sunday. Like it is just exhausting. And the normal life of the church doesn't just stop for VBS week. The pastor's still visiting, the deacons are still doing deacon stuff, whatever they do. But it's just exhausting. So great positive, tough to keep doing.
Positives, I would say, first of all, it can be a valuable evangelistic opportunity for families in your community. The counter side, the negative to that is very often, I don't say very often, the potential is that it isn't, that it becomes essentially an in-house thing for families in your church, and it's somewhat insular, and it just becomes kind of like a Bible daycare camp thing for your own families. And that's fine as far as it goes, but I just don't think all the volunteer effort and everything that you put into it is maximizing the potential if it's not being used to somehow share the gospel with those outside.
Agree.
And so the best VBSs, I think, are those that really do not just like get, you know, unsaved kids in the room, but are somehow making overtures or opening doors to families in the community. And so one of the positives, I think, is just the flexibility that we might have in how we do this. So At my church in Vermont, we did something, we called it Vocation Bible School. And this was actually the idea of the previous pastor, the former pastor who I succeeded. He and his wife are still in the church, and they had this idea of, and so let's not do it during the day, let's do it in the evening so that whole families can come, including dads. And let's do it around hobbies and skills so that we're offering little classes on.
Oh, nice.
You want to come learn photography? we've got a thing on photography. So one of our church members is going to do a photography class. You want to come look for bugs? We got a bug identifying class.
Yeah.
Small engine repair we had. So we had different members, different specialties. So it employed a lot of the men in our church who had different things or like, I don't know if I could stand up and teach from this curriculum, but I could, you know, show somebody how a lawnmower works and everything. Yeah. And then we would all meet together, all together in one room, and there would be a gospel presentation or some kind of Bible lesson for everybody. But we had more buy-in from our neighborhood.
Yeah, like very good.
Families were coming, whole families were coming, and dads and sons are taking small engine repair together, you know, that sort of thing. And it was just a, you know, an alternative way to do it. But the idea was, how can we position this to reach families?
Yeah.
I think you can do that with a traditional VBS. You just have to be somewhat flexible.
Yeah.
When, how, maybe even the marketing of it. So, you know, that sort of thing.
I think what we're reminding people is, remember, normal life exists. Do you know, like, as in, how are the families going to interact in normal life? Plug into that. I like it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The other thing I would just say, one of the negatives, historically, I don't know if this is much the case anymore. I imagine it probably is still happening, maybe not as widespread. But when I was a kid, there was like what was kind of the easy decisionism in the church trickled down into this VBS thing where you've got kids praying the sinner's prayer every single night. Yeah. And there just isn't a lot of conceptualization of, first of all, parental involvement in a child's spiritual decisions, and then even a church's sense of how conversion connects to church membership or discipleship, those sorts of things. I'm not saying you don't share the gospel with children at all. I'm just saying I remember driving my daughters when they were little to a different church's Awana program and having a conversation with them about, hey, if anyone tries to corner you and pray some prayer with you, like, you tell them to please talk to dad. And it wasn't because I didn't want them getting saved or anything like that. I didn't want someone else directing their sense of what conversion was and what salvation was. I want to be trusted to lead them to Christ in that way. Mm. And I'm fine if they come to Christ in a, you know, outside of my eyesight. But I just was concerned because of how I grew up with this sort of the tyranny of like the sinner's prayer is everything. And you're not feeling it today, but, you know, pray the sinner's prayer again. And that just kind of decisional regeneration and
but it's also
the pressure of that and the emotionalism of that.
I agree, but I think you're almost spiritualizing some of it in the sense of, I think some churches just want the numbers. They just want to say out loud 11 people.
Sure, that's why they're doing it, a lot of them,
And I think, I don't even know if they're going to the spiritualization of saying, man, you know, 11 kids gave their life to the Lord. I think they just want to see the number. Yeah. And so maybe behind your VBS, be focused on the individuals rather than the numbers. So maybe you can say to your church, hey, we had 100 kids that heard the gospel. That is a far better way of targeting, if you will. Yeah. We've reached 100 families with the gospel. And this sounds overly harsh. I don't really want to hear the number. And six people gave their life to Christ.
Yeah.
Just tell me the impact that this has had. And we are praying for those 100 families. You know?
And maybe even like, does it open the door to talk to parents to say,
hey,
your child indicated this week that they were interested in, you know, having knowing a spiritual more. Conversation or knowing more about Jesus. And can we talk together? You know, that sort of thing.
Yep.
In any event, just to be careful about those sorts of things, we've probably gone on longer on that question than we need to, but thank you, Bob. RJ on Facebook, RJ says, I know being gospel-centered means avoiding the pragmatism of the seeker-sensitive movement, but it seems like there are some unavoidable pragmatic issues that pastors will face. How much should a pastor care about the non-pastoral needs of a church? Budgeting, leadership, administration, hiring, firing staff, taking care of buildings, etc. Very common question. I used to get it a lot more than I do these days, so I appreciate the kind of renewal of this interest. Two things I would say, RJ. First of all, pragmatic is not the same thing as practical.
Yes.
And gospel centrality is not opposed to the practical. So there's lots of practical things that we do in our church that pastors are to do, what other church leaders and church members are to do. And being focused on the gospel or centered on the gospel does not mean that we're impractical about everything else or don't care about practical things. It just means we're putting the gospel in the center and the practical things on the periphery. But we do care about those things. So to be pragmatic is when you take the practical and turn it into a formula. If I do this, I'll get this result. This is the recipe for this. Practicality may involve some flexibility. It means using best practices, wisdom here and there, adapting things, contextualizing things, that sort of thing. And so I would apply to issues particularly of like budgeting, leadership, administration, hiring, firing, what you're mentioning there, that those are practical things that still need to be gospel-centered.
I agree.
We need to think about, as we're hiring and firing, how do we do this in a gracious way, a way that makes Jesus look big, et cetera. So I wouldn't say they're pragmatic, but practical. And we bring the gospel to bear on the practical. But I do think there are some things that it's okay to be, quote-unquote, pragmatic about. He mentions taking care of buildings.
Yeah.
I think there's a gospel-centered approach, I suppose, or we have in mind the stewardship of the building, and that's connected, of course, to our desire to that people know Jesus. But when it comes time to, like, okay, when is it the right time to replace the toilet paper rolls?
Yeah.
Where should the signage be, and what should it say? I think it's okay to be, quote-unquote, pragmatic about those things because they don't have a direct connection to a spiritual outcome. Mm. You can say, well, we're going to put it where people's eyesight best is.
Yeah.
That's the formula. You know what? Yeah. Be pragmatic about that. I think that's fine.
So I just put the question was, how much should a pastor care about these things?
Mm.
So I personally think a pastor should care. I think he should be well-versed in pretty much everything that's happening in the church. But that does not mean he needs to be involved
with
everything. And I think I've not always got that right in the past in my ministry. And I think I got to the stage where I used to just say to people, hey, just send me an email, like to a deacon that was on buildings. Hey, send me an email detailing all the kind of activities we've been doing this month in the building, the things you're worried about. And if you need me, feel free, I can come for a walk around the building. And then every year we did a full walk around the building as a full team and I was there. And the idea was I want to be well-versed on the problems of our building as well as the general activities of our building. One, so I can encourage the church, hey, you know, I'm hearing from our deacons, this room's been used inappropriate. Can we love the deacons and not do, you know, on those sorts of things? So I think be well-versed means you do care. But I would just question involvement. I don't think you need to be involved in absolutely every single thing.
Yeah.
You know, if you have hired staff members and there is a process in terms of hiring and firing, let's say you have a guy that comes to shovel your snow every winter and let's say the job's not being done well, I do not feel like the pastor has to be in the room to fire that individual and change contracts. But he does need to know what's happening. He does need to be well-versed that that's going to be happening. One, in case questions come up, because he will often be the lead voice on those matters. But two, so that he can help those that are doing it. You know, firing a staff member is not easy. So, you know, he wants to be able to check in on that person, say, hey, I know you just had to make a difficult call. How do you feel about that? Can I help you in any form of way? Do you know? So I would say well-versed, but that doesn't mean involved in everything.
Do some of these, like some of what you were just saying, does it depend on the context of the church or the size?
Because
I can picture like a big staff, lots of pastors where maybe the question almost presupposes like a senior pastor.
Yeah.
Does a senior pastor need to know that the executive pastor is firing the guy who shovels the snow? Maybe not. If the church is really big, I mean.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of things here that you can go backwards and forwards. I would say as a general rule, more information share is better than less as a general rule. Yeah.
And as a general rule, being a pastor does not mean that you're disconnected from the practicalities
of
your church.
Exactly those things. I would say one of the things that my kind of right-hand man, so to speak, in my last church did is every year he would just give me a rundown. This is kind of what we think is happened this year. This is what we think is going to happen in the coming year. Big things, small things, even the smallest things off, we're changing our internet provider. Just so you know, it's not been great. So we're changing it. So that was always helpful for me. So I would say, yes, please do care about all these things in your church, but it's okay to delegate and let somebody else do it.
That's good. Brandon via email. And what's that email address, Ross?
mailbag@ftc.co.
Okay, mailbag@ftc.co. Brandon via email says, what does it take for a church merger to be successful? I.e., how much doctrinal alliance, leadership change, 50-50 versus complete submission, et cetera. I'm not an expert on church mergers. My understanding, based on the people I know who have seen them conducted successfully, means you need total clarity and total agreement.
Yes. Yep. Yep.
It does not work if you have let's just try this out.
Yep.
Or there's a lack of clarity on the membership. So typically when a merger happens, and this isn't, it's all kinds of mergers, but typically we're looking at almost like a church sort of subsuming another church, usually a larger church that is growing and another church that's struggling or maybe even on the verge of having to close its doors. And rather than having to close its doors or find someone else to kind of replant that church individually, they merge with another church. Another church kind of assumes them. And I think when this happens, the church that's being assumed or being brought in, the smaller church, typically has to have total clarity.
Yeah.
We're going to be under that doctrine.
Yep.
We're going to be under that leadership. Or there's some shared leadership. Maybe the existing pastor and the pastor of the larger church have some agreement of we're going to co-pastor. Or you're going to be on staff, not as the lead guy, but as another staff pastor. Whatever that arrangement is, it just needs to be so clear.
Yes. And there needs to
be
agreement.
And there's needs to be total buy-in for this thing. It can't be just a, all right, let's bring the step kids together and see how it works.
And I don't think this is what Brandon's meaning per se in his questioning, but I just want to kind of show where the negative is this. He said, how much doctrinal alliance leadership change? 50-50 versus complete submission. So 50-50, already you're saying, if we don't have 50-50, then we might not be in agreement. Complete submission, oh, you need to be over us, we need to be below you. How much alliance can we have? What can we disagree on? Really, those kind of examples he's giving, what you're trying to basically find out is how can everyone get a little bit of skin in the game and feel happy about it? You know, here's my doctrine, here's my, you know, I want my leader in. I have witnessed one merger personally, and this was years ago in Scotland in a small town. It was really difficult because both had churches, buildings, both were fully paid off, both had staff members, both had dwindling congregations, both were known for being different. One was called the High Church. It was literally on the hill. And one was called Lowland. And it was literally on the lower end. Wow. And they argued over name. So it was, should it be the Low and High Church? Should it be the High and Low Church? And what I would say is, people just wanted their preferences, you know, so they went for a brand new name because they just said, rather than have, you know, us argue over this, go for a brand new name. And what I would say—
Could they agree on that?
They struggled. Okay. So I think it just became like, I'm not going to say the town, but say the town church, you know, it just became really simplified. What I would say is if you're going to merge, it can't be like a business merger where everyone gets a little bit of thing, a little bit of skin in the game, and they're all a little bit happy and everyone's had to do a little bit of compromise. It can't be like that. It has to be, we are one unified church.
Yeah.
There is no disagreement as we come doctrinally together, no disagreement when we come building together. And yes, we have ended up being a 50-50 leadership, but that's because that's what we agreed on.
Yeah, I think it certainly helps when the church is already, when it says, how much doctrinal alliance, I would think,
man,
like, you've got to be like-minded to begin with.
Yeah.
I mean, how are you going to sort through, we're, you know.
Mainly, if there's minor quibbles, okay. But what we're talking about is fundamentally, this is what you're going to get people to come in as members as.
Yeah, even on the level of, I mean, you certainly have to have first tier order things because you wouldn't be Christian if you didn't.
But I think a lot of second tier issues.
Second tier, you need to, I think, have shared second tier issues or you're going to start having some real problems.
Yeah.
And this happens. There are smaller churches that are just like, we don't want to die.
Yeah.
So yeah, swallow us up. We'll become members of your church essentially. It's not, I mean, it's a merger, but it's really
basically we're here's joining the keys your to the building.
And here's the keys to our stuff. And, and those are the ones that seem to work the best when someone can really kind of wave the white flag and not say, well, we want to merge because we don't want to die, but we don't want to change.
Yeah.
Because that's just not possible.
Yeah.
Okay, this comes from Josh on Twitter. Josh says, as a staff pastor, how do you go about when you and your senior pastor disagree on philosophy of ministry and oversight of church ministries? My question is pretty simple to this, which is if you're not in the lead pastor position, you're not in the position to cast vision or make decisions. And if your senior pastor is not one who is open to alternative views, open to your, I don't know if you want to call it counsel or influence. Some guys, they are very open to that. Hey, I could be wrong.
Yeah.
Like, what are you reading, youth pastor? What are you reading, associate pastor? How's it helping you? Maybe I could learn from it. But some guys are like, no, this is the direction. Mm-hmm. This is the vision. And that's the position they're in. And if you're not in that position, there's really not much you can do. You can influence as you're able. But by and large, you're not there to set the vision, at least by job description. He's there to set the vision. So learn what you can, serve how you can, but if you're at a crisis of conscience, I've rarely seen a guy change a church from the second or third chair.
Yep.
And in fact, you end up, even if you're in the right, if you're a gospel-centered guy or whatever, you can cause division and tension in a church where if you try to do that from the second or third chair, and it likely just means you need to learn what you can and maybe find a yep. role elsewhere that's more aligned with your philosophy.
This was my second church. Mm-hmm. This was exactly my experience. I was in the second chair and we had a disagreement on philosophy of ministry. I tried exactly what you said, learn what you can, see how you can influence as you can. It boiled down to making a decision of one of two ways. I either fight, because you're going to fight at some level. If you disagree that fundamentally, you're going to fight, or I leave. Mm. And if I ask him to leave, that's just fighting. So that was the choice I had before me. And we decided to leave before we started to fight. There was almost like an air of fighting beginning. Yeah. And we just decided, actually, I don't want to do this to the church. So we left. And I would just say simply this, when you are hiring pastors, when you're electing lay elders, whatever your model is in that sense, you have to talk about this before you bring them in. You need to, one of the things I did in all of my churches is when we hire staff, we would go out for lunch, an extended lunch, and we would just talk. We'd see how we get on with each other, what our philosophy of ministry is, the areas that we, like, what's your hard lines? Like, we're not talking doctrines. We're talking about just how you manage your days. What's your hard lines? What you are you going to be out at the office at 5 p.m. because of your kids? Okay, I need to know that ahead of time. So a big thing is, and I'm going to kind of promote this, hire from within your church, because the likelihood is they already share that philosophy.
Yeah,
so it maybe doesn't resolve this issue that Josh is in. I think you're either going to probably leave or fight. I think that's probably going to be the situation. But I think for stopping this happening, I think hire from within your church, elect from within your church, because that philosophy of ministry is there. The negative is you're maybe not getting something new and fresh coming in, but the positive is you're probably going to avoid this situation.
That's good. Okay, this comes from Justin on Facebook. Justin asks, I've heard it said that pastors should not have close friends in the church they pastor to protect from favoritism and decision-making or church discipline and to protect the pastor from getting hurt. But I don't see this in the Bible. Can you speak to the kinds of relationships a pastor can and should have with the other members of his church?
Well, I don't know if we're going to agree on this one.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I don't know. So
now I'm intrigued.
My issue is with the word close. So
okay.
I think a pastor should have friends in the church.
Okay.
Absolutely do. At Nine Marks, we're actually recently here on campus talking about the pastor should be friends with the church.
Yeah.
By nature of just spending so much time with people and caring for them, you begin to love them.
Yeah.
They're fellow brothers and sisters in Christ. You love them. You care for them. There are some that you might struggle with and you don't spend as much time with, but there's definitely going to be people you have friends with. The close friends, and I'm going to caveat this with, I think this has been my experience. So I don't necessarily think this is advice. This has just been something I struggle with. I have been hurt so many times by having very close relationships, either by that individual's sin, them leaving church, even just feeling like I preached a bad sermon and while our friendship's already rocky because of that, I think it's just maybe naive to say that your closest friends will be within the church as a pastor.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say you can't have them. I just think it's naive to think that that's exactly where you're going to find them, because there is always those moments where you just think, I need to be more pastor than I am friend in this exact moment. And I personally found that very difficult to do. My closest friends were the people I served alongside with,
yeah,
or were out with of the church. I had friends in the church. They just weren't my closest. So I'm going to say, I think it's wrong to say, no, you can't have close friends. I think it is right to say you can have friends. I think it's naive to say your closest friends will be within the church.
We're not in disagreement.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I'm taking him on face value here.
Yeah.
I would disagree with the forbidding of having close friends in the church. In my experience, it hasn't been that easy.
Yeah, yeah.
I can think of one church where we had what I would consider like best friends or close friends.
Yeah,
which isn't to say that I haven't been close with people in any church experience, but in terms of just like, man, like the closest friends, best friends, and I'm still close best friends with them. That was in one church experience. Yeah. So if you can, you know, don't put a wall up there because you're afraid of getting hurt or in fact, the church is the place where we're meant to be sharing our hearts with each other because of what Christ is, you know, he's made us one.
Yeah.
And to sort of close off emotionally from that, I think wouldn't be getting out of it all that the Lord is giving you.
Yeah.
The reality, though, is for pastors, very often It's just not possible.
No.
And so I would say every pastor should be a friend to everyone in their
yes,
church.
Yes, correct.
But it's not possible for any pastor to be friends with everyone
yeah.
in their church.
Yeah.
It's just not, just because yeah. of the nature of friendship and the way friendship works. We know how we make friends, and it's typically some level of happenstance, providence,
yeah.
chemistry,
yep.
something. You just click with somebody, and sometimes you just don't click with
yeah.
people in your church. So you can be a friend to them. It's very rare for you to be friends with them. And
yeah.
even this comes up a lot, I think, with pastors' wives sometimes. It happens with guys and pastors, I think, but more often there are women in the church who – they have it in their heads, I'm going to be the pastor's wife's
yeah.
friend.
Yeah.
And they forget that the pastor's wife gets to pick her own friends.
Yeah. I was same with the pastor's kids as well.
Oh, pastor's kids. That's yeah. right. Okay. And that can cause some stressors.
Uh-huh.
And so just a reminder that, like, it's okay for your wife to not be best friends with
yeah.
every woman in your church.
Yeah.
For the same reason, it's okay for you to not be best friends with every man in your church, but to be a friend to them, to be friendly mm-hmm. with everyone. But to have her own friends. And even yeah. we see this model, I think, even with Jesus. I mean,
yeah.
so there was the wider community. There was those yeah. that followed. We you know, have been preaching through Acts, and recently in Acts 1, we see that even the reference to Peter makes a reference to, from the beginning of the ministry, there was a wider community of folks that just kind of followed along.
Yeah.
So they had that. But then there was the 12, and Jesus was closer with the 12. But then even within the 12, Peter, James, and John seem to be the ones that
yep.
he's like super tight with. But then even between Peter, James, and John, there's
the
disciple
John.
Whom Jesus loved,
yeah.
which is John. So it's like Jesus had a best friend, then he had three close friends,
yeah.
then he had 12 good friends,
and then he had everyone
he's friendly with and friendly to.
Do you know a yeah. good barometer in all of it, and this is what I found, is this is a random one. The people I have to change my house for, like internally, like clean up and get everything organized
and look like
the pastor's family,
yeah, yeah.
to me, that's like friends. I'm okay with it, but I'm more pastor than friend, if you will. But the ones that I could just go, I'm in my shorts and t-shirt, I'm just chilling out of the house. House is not in the best state. And I'm like, oh, I'm really glad that you've come over. I think those are the people you think, huh, I'm actually becoming friends with you because I'm not having yeah. to put on a persona. And I think that's especially as well for pastors' wives. I've seen it. And just as an example, in my last church, we grew very close to one family very quickly, a very similar mindset. Our kids loved each other. We often just ordered pizza. Like, who cares? Let's just order pizza.
Yeah.
And I know in our church, there was ever so slightly a friction with some people thinking, wow, they're really close. Number one, I worked with the guy. Number two, they accepted where we are as a family. They often saw me as Ross, not Pastor Ross. And the ones that had frictions were often the ones that were causing problems in church.
Yeah.
And they would use that friendship going, see, you favoritize. And you're kind of going, actually, see, this is the problem. Like, you're complaining about the
yeah.
things all the time. So one thing I would just say, it's just naive. I think that's the thing I would say. I would love it. I would really love it if we could say we could be close friends with a lot of people in church.
Yeah.
But also, it depends on personality. I'm the type of guy that has maybe 5 close friends. My wife is maybe somebody that has 1. I also have a friend of mine who's like friends with everybody. Everyone's
yeah.
his best buddy.
Yeah.
And you just think, I don't have energy for that.
Yeah, I think also there's a difference between, so Justin mentions like favoritism in decision-making or church discipline. There's a difference between somebody accusing you of that or feeling like that's a deal and it actually being a
truth.
And so
yeah.
you have to, but I do think you need to protect yourself against it, in that being a real friend means not, being a real friend to somebody doesn't mean that you don't share the hard things with them.
Yeah.
And I can think distinctly of a relationship I had with a guy who we were pretty close, and I wouldn't say we were best friends, but we were pretty close friends and we did a lot of stuff together. And then there came the day where I had to put the pastor hat on.
Yeah.
And in his mind, I was violating the relationship.
Yeah.
Like, what do you mean? Suddenly you got to call me on the floor? Like, you're going to like confront me about
yeah.
this thing in my marriage? And what do you mean you're going to like church discipline for unrepentant? Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
And I had to explain to him that, like, this isn't just me putting the pastor hat on. This is me being your
friend.
Being
a friend. Yeah.
Because what kind of friend am I if I don't, like,
yeah.
and vice versa. If you see me in patterns of unhealth, yeah. if you know I'm making a you know, garbage out of my marriage or something, like, what kind of friend are you that you wouldn't say something
yeah.
and speak up? So this isn't just me being your pastor. this is me actually being your friend.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so just make sure that if you are close friends with people, that it doesn't mean you show them, quote unquote, favoritism. Yeah. And let them off the hook when it comes time to actually pastor them and shepherd them in the same way that you would want them to, in a sense, pastor or speak into your life as well.
Before we move on, I know we probably spent a lot of time on this. On the opposite side as well, if you're a friend with the pastor and he messes up, that's not a moment for you to just walk away and just go, we're done with friendship. Mm-hmm. I have done that, especially in my early years of ministry, wasn't great as an example. And I don't have friendships with some people because they had put me in a position of he can do no wrong. And then I did wrong. And it's like, man, he's just a failure. I never want to be friends with him. So you got to give and take a little bit. Your pastor's not perfect. He's going to have issues. A good friend's going to know that and ride that journey with him.
Yeah. This comes from Taylor via email. And that email address, again, is mailbag@ftc.co.
Yes.
Okay. Taylor via email. He says, does it matter what a church sings on Sunday mornings for worship? Is there a difference in songs that a congregation can sing together and songs written by Christians?
I think he's probably meaning just like performance songs.
Just like maybe. Any kind of song written by Christians. Okay. How do you teach a congregation to care about what they sing corporately? My answer is really short.
Yep.
Does it matter? Of course it does. Yes. There's two primary things, because I think contextually the style or whatever may be different church to church, culture to culture. Two main things. Is it rooted in scripture? Mm-hmm. The lyrics are theologically biblical. And two, is it singable? Can the congregation sing it together?
Yes.
Which kind of rules out, it might rule out some theologically rich songs that are just really hard for congregations to sing together. They're better for just listening on your own, for personal edification, maybe hearing at a concert. Maybe you sing along at the concert. But for congregational singing, the song needs to be designed and written in such a way that it's not hard to follow for all kinds of singers and you know, different voices that they're able to sing it together, which is why the hymns, I think, endure. Yeah. It's not just tradition. Some people, like, they're so allergic to hymns. They're like, it's just old. And no, like, those people know what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
The reason they wrote those hymns that way, and you might want to update language or something. I would advise you not to do that. But, you know, the archaic language or whatever. But they were singable. They were in familiar tunes. They're written in reliable, discernible patterns and cadence. And they just, you know, there's some, you know, hymns that aren't, you know, that are less easy to sing, I suppose. But the ones that have endured tend to be ones that lots of people can sing. They're easy to follow along.
Yep. I agree 100%. And just from a practical way of how do you teach your congregation to care about what they sing corporately, Sunday evening, Sunday school, Wednesday nights, teach some songs. Like literally teach the lines. Where do we see this in scripture? Why would this be a pattern? What's the history behind this song? Why did this person write this? And maybe you teach that song and then you sing that song for the following month every single week within a church. At our members' meetings at Liberty Baptist, one of our pastors, Paul, he'll stand up and he'll just say, okay, voices only. Here's the hymn book. We're going to go. I know we're going to be uncomfortable, but let's just go for it. So don't just go, it's important what to sing, rich theologically, let's do it. Actually teach them and give them avenues to grasp hold on to that. And remember, your church is probably listening to K-Love every single day. And so maybe create a playlist. Our church has created a playlist of 100 songs sung in roughly the style that we would sing them in church. And get your church listening to the songs that you're going to sing.
Yeah.
Sorry if you love K-Love. but that's a really practical way. Here's a Spotify list. Here's an Apple iTunes list. Here's the reason why we're adding this song into our list. You know, just give them information and practical ways of engaging with it.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that Pastor Paul does really well too is he doesn't bombard us with new songs constantly.
I agree.
So when he introduces a song, he does it kind of sparingly and
maybe does one every few months.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah. So it's at a pace we can absorb. But the playlist thing, I hadn't thought of that. That's really helpful too. What I have noticed is just the families in our church tend to use a lot of the songs that we sing or songs like them in their family worship or just play, even
just
what they listen to in the car. They're not listening to
K-Love.
They're listening to versions of these songs that we do in the minivan with the kids. And so the songs are being disseminated into their regular life as well, which makes it easier.
And it sounds so much better when you come to church and you all sing together rather than just your like, well, you're my awful voice in the car, and I get to bring it to 100, 200, 300 people and go, yeah. huh, this is what this sounds like when we all sing it together.
You know what I've noticed recently, and I don't know if this is new. It feels new. Maybe I'm just noticing it recently. People singing in parts.
Oh, yeah.
That's like a really, that's an advanced level of congregational singing again, where people are doing the harmony and the different parts. I've noticed that now more. And I'll tell you why.
Paul's encouraged that.
Well, there's that. But I just think at our church, you can hear people singing.
100%.
Yeah. When I travel again, different styles, different contexts. I know what people resonate with is different. And, you know, as long as the song's theologically rich and it's singable. But it's so common to be at churches and I'm just like, I don't know if people are singing or not. All I hear is what's on stage and it's so loud.
Yep.
And I know I sound like an old person saying this, but you're 100% if you're leading the congregation and singing, the dominant voice should be the congregation singing.
We noticed this last year. We went to, I think it was like 16 different churches with pulpit supply and visiting and all that sort of thing. Every single one had the exact same two issues. Every single one. Number one, way too loud through the speakers. Number two, when the moments came where the voices had to be lifted, you know, where they did pull back, next to nobody was singing.
Yeah.
And every single time we were away and then we came back to our own church, and this is really just showing love on our own church. Man, we don't even need instruments. It's beautiful that we do have them, but we don't need them. I can't hear myself sing. That's how loud everyone's singing. Mm. And maybe it's the practicality. Maybe it's because of what we believe. Maybe it's just our building. I'm not going to say we're better than others. What I'm saying, though, is I am seeing a pattern. A performance from the front with high volume just doesn't bless the church as a room of 100 people saying, thick and thin, we are going through this together. And these words are stunningly beautiful about our Lord Jesus. And it's just one of those things that draws me back to our church so many times. I've said this to you before, when we've traveled, it's just something special coming back after we've traveled to your own church and saying, you know, this is the people we're with. And one of the biggest things that we love is just the volume of singing, specifically from our men.
Mm.
From our men at Liberty. They really do sing loud.
Okay, finally, this comes from Kenny on Twitter. Kenny says, what food should you bring to a church potluck?
And for those in the UK, a potluck is a fellowship meal.
Fellowship meal. I was about to ask you, what do you call it over in the UK? What food should you bring? I'm going to violate my Baptist cred here.
Okay.
It's so rare for me to like anything brought to a potluck.
Uh-huh.
I'm not a big fan of the potluck. I'm fine with the fellowship, but the potluck idea, I don't like it. I like to order my own food, to pick my own food.
Yeah.
Typically, in my experience, potlucks are full of casseroles. And I despise, even the word casserole almost like triggers the gag reflex in my. I don't like mayonnaise-y things. I don't like multiple things thrown together into a thing.
Yeah.
I don't like stuff that you crumble things on top. I don't like noodle-y things, noodle salads and noodle dishes. And
okay. Don't sit next to you at potluck.
It's just a lot. Yeah. A lot of that happens at potlucks. People bring the dishes and I just. So what food should you bring? Just a good solid meat choice.
So casseroles, so a couple of things. Miriam and I talked about this last night. We went to a church and they had a Jell-O lime green salad with coconut bits in it.
Nope.
And I pointed it and I said, what's that? And by the tone I said, what's that? The person was quite offended. So here's the thing. Just generally something that most people would eat.
Yeah.
So I went to one potluck and they had a mystery meat casserole. And it turned out to be both moose and goose.
Now, see, if you told me that, I might be interested, actually.
No, don't give me mystery meat. Just tell me what's in the thing. So what most people can eat. So don't go super spicy. Don't go super bland. You know, just hit that world in the middle. Something that's easily serverable. Yeah. You know, at the end of the day, I went to a preached at a church recently, and they went for lasagnas from Costco. They just bought a pile of lasagnas from Costco.
I might would eat that, actually.
And again, it was just, they cut it into squares, really easily servable. I'm going to also say this. Potlucks can be a moment where families will think, oh, I should bring some food. Singles and younger people sometimes don't really know what to bring because maybe they don't cook as much or whatever.
Bring a bag of chips.
I am totally happy if you just bring a pizza. Like I'm like, bring.
And so will children.
So
actually.
Will children, exactly. So I'm also happy if
children
you go.
Children and Ross will be happy.
Yeah, go to Sam's Club and buy a big chocolate cake. I brought dessert. Like if you don't know what to bring, go and buy something.
Yeah,
it's
nobody
absolutely
cares.
Fine. No one.
And it's going to actually be better than 90% of what people bring from their house if they cooked in their kitchen. Yeah. I'm telling you the truth.
So I went and visited one church and they said they were going to have a potluck, but it was I think they called it something like a service potluck or something like that, or no service potluck. Nobody was to do anything. There was no prep. So they ordered in just pizzas and different things and just said, look, if it's not your thing, that's fine. But no one wants to work today. Mm. So they just did what was available.
Somebody had to wash dishes, I would guess.
No, they just paper plates. Here's my biggest thing. Me and you went to a conference once.
Yeah.
And I asked, what is for breakfast? Because it was a breakfasty kind of lunch meal together. And they said, you'll love it. Okay. Like, that's not the question I asked. What's in it?
Yeah.
Oh, you'll see. No, I want to know now what I'm going to eat.
So I can prepare.
So yeah, no mystery meats, no like, you'll just love it.
And it happened to be, we won't say it because someone will know, but there was one thing that, an American breakfast item that you do not like.
I really do not like.
And it happened to be that breakfast item.
And not only did I have
and
one.
And it was the only option.
But they then came and brought the second one to me because there was some left over and they wanted to bless us. Yeah, and they gave me another one. I was
what
just thinking.
Ugh.
So yeah, rule of thumb, what most people will like. And if you really don't know, just buy a bag of chips, get some cookies, buy a cake. It really isn't a problem. And I agree, the bought stuff is usually better.
You know what's great about the potluck is you discover which families in your church can't cook.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
You guys are eating this every night? No wonder you're so grumpy.
Yeah.
You
don't know. and then you also discover some really – so I've learned this. This is a little trick I've learned. If you find out – I really like desserts.
Okay.
If you find out the desserts that you really like and find out who made them and then go and say to that person, hey, your chocolate cake is just amazing. What you will often find is that chocolate cake appears at your house in the upcoming weeks.
That's right.
So – little tip for you folks out there, if you really like some food at potluck,
good.
Let them know.
Use some subtle manipulation that Ross learned from one of his business books, probably.
Yes.
On that note, thank you for the great questions. There's even a couple that I skipped that we had on the list because we ran out of time. We'll save that for later. You can, share your questions with us on social media, but that's why we mentioned this email address as well. You can send a question anytime. Right now you're thinking, oh, I wonder if they would talk about this. Email us right now, mailbag@ftc.co, and then it'll be there. You don't need to wait for me to go, hey, what kind of questions would you like us to cover? Just send an email. Mm-hmm. And if you enjoy the podcast in general, give us a good review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. And until next time. May Jesus be big in your potluck and in your church. You've been listening to the For the Church podcast, hosted by Jared Wilson, found online at ftc.co. This resource is brought to you by Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Kansas City, Missouri, where we train leaders for the church.